A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven,
concentrate
on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 363. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about The Phoenix and the Carpet. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
We are talking about a classic tea time serial, late afternoon serialized production from the BBC in 1976. It ran for a total of 8 30-minute episodes, and it was an adaptation of a novel by Edith Nesbit.
It was indeed. And as you say, Brian, this is classic BBC tea time adaptation of a source novel, fantasy adventure serial. The BBC doing what they do with adapting these classic pieces of children's literature and doing it, you know, with their own particular style.
Yes, absolutely.
So the setup for The Phoenix and the Carpet starts with four young children and their baby brother who live in Edwardian London of the very early 1900s or thereabouts. And they're out on a shopping expedition with their mother when they discover a rolled-up Persian carpet for sale outside a junk shop at a reasonable price, and it catches their interest.
And they see it as a perfect replacement for the nursery carpet they had at home, which the children had previously ruined. So we know right from then that they can be hard on the things they have around at home. And their mother buys this on approval, so it's being delivered to their home, rolled up, and they'll have the chance to approve whether they want to keep it and pay for it or not. And of course, when they get it home, they open it up. It's this strange and wonderful carpet, and there is a golden egg sitting in it.
But of course there is. It's got to be a large golden egg. And of course that golden egg is going to be then at some point accidentally fall onto the fireplace that the carpet is unrolled in front of. And in the fire it will crack open and reveal the magical golden phoenix of the title. This magical creature who can speak and will inform the children of several things, but particularly that the carpet itself is also magical and can grant them their wishes. And that's really sets us off on the adventure in this sort of like fantasy serial. Children with a magic carpet, a guiding presence of a magical creature, and some magic wishes that they get to come true.
Yes, absolutely.
So let's talk about the characters, the children. They are very much front and center. This is a classic children's serial with the kids as the main protagonists. And I'd guess, Brian, they're about, they're pre-teen. They're sort of 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, that sort of age, aren't they?
Yes, it's something along those lines with a group of four siblings who form this quite close unit at the center of the story.
So we'll start with the eldest, who is Cyril, or as he's nicknamed by the rest of his siblings, Squirrel, played by Gary Russell, the oldest, the lead of the children, the one who seems to take the lead role in making decisions when they're out and about and when they're on their adventures.
And I was rather amused to see that Cyril was played by Gary Russell, who would go on to be a director, producer, and writer for Big Finish.
Oh, is that the same Gary Russell? Fascinating.
That is absolutely the same Gary Russell. And if you followed discussions from people who work at Big Finish and so on, it is from time to time mentioned that he was a child actor. And you could recognize him. I've met him before, and it's very much the same person. So interesting to see him still as a creative, but in a very different way. He's now working at the animation house that has done some of the Doctor Who Missing Episode animated recreations. including Fury from the Deep. So that connection I thought was quite fun.
Fantastic. Well spotted.
Next in order is Anthea, or Panther as she's nicknamed, played by Tamsin Neville, the second oldest, and she is sort of the practical one and often the one who figures things out, and where Cyril is taking on the sort of leadership role, she's also taking on some of the responsibility and often is the one who logically figures things out and is sort of important to deciding where they will do things and how things will go.
Yes, an interesting character. We'll come back to her. Third down, so is Robert, or Bobs, played by Max Harris. He is the slightly more misadventurous one, the one who's more sort of slightly more prone to doing things on impulse. The child who accidentally drops the egg on the fire, and as a result seems to be somewhat of the Phoenix's favourite, particularly towards the end of this show. I think that is specifically mentioned, that the Phoenix tends to favour Bobs.
Yeah, Bobs and the Phoenix have sort of a connection, and whenever they go somewhere with the Phoenix, it will be Robert who has the Phoenix hidden under his coat and that sort of thing. So there is sort of a connection there that we see. The youngest of the four is Jane, nicknamed Pussy. We don't hear the nickname very much. Played by Jane Foster. And she's the one who needs the most looking after. She's very clearly the youngest of this group of four, but has a lot to say as well, and is an interesting character in this dynamic as well, I think.
So, four kids, two boys, two girls, very classic setup, but they've also got their younger brother, Hillary, the baby. Although I don't think we hear the name very often, if at all. He's always referred to as the Lamb. A child who seems to be suffering from whooping cough at the start of this series. Sometimes the children have to take the baby with them, and sometimes the baby will crawl onto the magic carpet and all sorts of mishaps will occur. But yes, they spend some time worrying about the lamb or looking after the lamb or taking the lamb somewhere exciting to try and cure its cough.
Yeah, he's definitely separate from that main group of four, but he does sort of show up and become involved from time to time, as a baby might, you know, being carried by someone and so on. Now, the Phoenix himself is this very important character, voiced by Richard Warner and operated by Joe Barton, who is quite a self-centered, haughty bird who has a very particular way of doing things, and he is quite insistent about how the children should do things and sort of guides them and sort of gives them advice and tells them what to do, which sometimes they do and sometimes they don't do.
This is true. They sometimes seem to carry on without waiting for the instructions.
Yes. And Richard Warner voices a wonderfully sort of full of himself, self-absorbed Phoenix character that I think worked really well in this.
He does indeed, yes.
So in addition to the characters and the Phoenix included, we have the carpet itself. So the children discover that standing on the carpet and making a wish allows them to travel to faraway lands and go on all sorts of adventures. It is, of course, a flying carpet.
As again, but of course.
Well, absolutely. They visit this mysterious tower in France and find some treasure there and discover a widow and her child who were in fact the rightful owners of the treasure. So you have things going on there.
Indeed. And of course, they also decide to take the lamb and their cook on a trip to the seaside. And they go to a sort of unspecified South Seas island, which has sun and sand and sea. But they get up into all sorts of troubles there, which we'll come back to. But they also visit an Indian queen. And as well as going on a sightseeing trip around Edwardian London, a trip where the Phoenix He's very gratified to see so many images of himself on buildings, but he's also, he gets rather headstrong on this trip and keeps rushing off, flying off and interfering when he, perhaps he should be spending more time hidden under Bob's jacket. In fact, he almost gets himself abducted in the process, I think, Brian.
Yes, the Phoenix is not known for exercising caution in this.
No.
And one of the things they realize on that first trip of theirs is that they get 3 wishes a day. And the wishes are all related to the carpet traveling somewhere, sometimes traveling somewhere and collecting something. And they have to be quite precise with the wishes, because if they say something that isn't quite clear, it will do something unexpected.
As ever, when it comes to magical carpets and wishes, there are rules, Brian, aren't there?
Absolutely. And the boundaries of those rules come to the fore, of course. So we should get into our production notes. This was based on a 1904 novel, The Phoenix of the Carpet, by Edith Nesbit, who lived from 1858 to 1924. She's probably best known for the novel The Railway Children from 1906 and the classic Lionel Jeffries film from 1970 based on that, which starred Jenny Agutter.
Which plays a huge part in pop culture, The Railway Children and the film, of course. So this book, The Phoenix and the Carpet, was a sequel, in fact, to an earlier novel for children, the 1902 novel by Edith Nesbit, 5 Children and It, in which the same family discover another magical creature, the Samoyed, if I'm saying that right, sand fairy, that also granted wishes. They're quite a lucky family. They keep discovering magical creatures. Although, I think in this series, Brian, on the TV, there's no mention of the fact that they've had previous adventures, I think.
Yes, that's right. This production was done sort of independently, and the fact that the book was a sequel to other adventures, they don't reference that.
But 5 Children and It has also been adapted by the BBC, actually rather later, 1991, and then a sequel series, 1993. It's not on our agenda at the moment, but it's on the possibles list, so it could come up in the distant future. Who knows, Brian?
Oh, absolutely.
And I should say there was a third book. There was a trilogy. So the book series continued and concluded with The Story of the Amulet in 1906. So she was putting these out every 2 years. And then also, as you say, Brian, putting out The Railway Children in 1906 as well. She was quite busy around then.
Yes, quite productive as an author. Certainly in that era before electric typewriters and word processing and so on. So The Phoenix and the Carpet had been previously read as a story on Jack and Ori on the BBC in 1965.
Yes, it would be, wouldn't it? Jack and Ori. We love a Jack and Ori story over here.
Yes, and they covered a lot of things for sure. But the 1976 version that we're talking about was produced by Dorothy Brooking, who had a long career in the BBC Children's Department going back to about 1950. And she produced a total of 3 different versions of The Secret Garden. She did Great Expectations and 5 Children and It in a 1951 production. So it had an even earlier one than this 90s one that we were referring to.
Yes, I know. I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing the 1951 does not survive, although obviously the 90s version does. She also did The Prince and the Pauper with Nicholas Lyndhurst, I remember. Tom's Midnight Garden, and perhaps most relevant to us because we have seen it and done it on this this podcast, A Traveller in Time was one of her series as well. She had an astonishingly lengthy career with the BBC, putting out all these adaptations of classics of literature.
Yes, that's quite a run of productions there and some quite significant stuff.
And then somewhere about 1975 or early 1976, she manages to convince the BBC's head of children productions, Monica Sims, that they had enough money left in the BBC's Birmingham studios budget to adapt The Phoenix and the Carpet, even with the special effects that they knew they would need to do The Phoenix and the flying sequences on the carpet. So having got the go-ahead, they got John Tully to adapt the book for the screen, and he'd worked with Brookin on Tom's Midnight Garden. He would later work on a series called Kizzy and Thursday's Child with her as well. And he did the sort of adaptation pretty faithfully, I believe, although I haven't read the book, but I believe this is fairly faithful to the novel, Brian.
Yes, I was thinking that it is probably quite faithful, and I haven't read the book either in this case. The series was directed by Clive Doig, who started his BBC career as a vision mixer on Doctor Who and went on to work on Vision On, which was this quite influential art show that was aimed at deaf and hearing impaired children and sort of gained a wider audience of children, but was very much about visuals.
And I don't know if you've ever come across Vision On, Brian, but I remember it from my childhood as an absolutely wonderful show that myself and my brothers watched. And we were quite fascinated, obviously, by the sign-in that would go on, as well as the sort of narration about art projects. But it also introduced to the screen, as far as I'm aware, the great children's artist Tony Hart, who would go on to do Take Heart and introduce Morph, that Aardman Innovations character, to us. And it also featured in a small role a young actor and comedian at the time, Sylvester McCoy. I think possibly his earliest TV roles were on Vision On.
Yes, he certainly was involved there and was doing sort of visual comedy things, I think.
He was doing mime and similar things, yes.
Yes, I've only seen clips. I don't know if Vision On is available in complete episodes anywhere, but it certainly sounds like a fascinating series. I would love to see a bit more of it.
It was great stuff. Arts on the telly for children.
So most of the filming for The Phoenix and the Carpet was done at Pebble Mills Studio in Birmingham. During the very hot summer of 1976, which perhaps helped to add to the quite summery tone that you have in this. This really feels like it's set in a hot summer as you watch it.
It does, yes.
And they used some stock footage in this of some of the exotic locations to set the tone. And a little bit of outside 16mm filming was done in London as well.
But one of the things we do know, as you say, Brian, is that the budget was fairly tight for things like outside filming and also for sets and costumes. And we know that they borrowed some of the costumes from another BBC costume drama, The Duchess of Duke Street, which was also being filmed at Pebble Mill, I believe, in Birmingham. And then also it mentions as an item of trivia that some of the sets may have been reused a year or so later for the Doctor Who serial The Horror of Fang Rock, because if I get this right, the production of Fang Rock had to move from London to Birmingham temporarily because the London studios for Doctor Who were undergoing some engineering works, and so it broke with tradition and actually they filmed one in Birmingham and possibly used some of these sets, I think, Brian.
Yes, I remember hearing that that one was moved to Birmingham for part of it. And maybe that was part of the tower set was redressed to make it look like a lighthouse. The Horror of Fang Rock was set in a lighthouse. So, yeah, interesting. And as this was the BBC, I think even with a stripped down budget, when doing a period drama, their costuming and their props and so on all look very good. Even on a low budget, the BBC is able to do that well.
They do indeed, yes. And we've got another slight Doctor Who connection because, of course, we've got an animatronic Phoenix, which was apparently created by the same BBC technical team who created K-9 for Doctor Who. So there's another little collection there as well, which is quite fun.
Oh, yes. I could see that there could be some similar things for that, and this probably was a more rushed project in some ways than K-9. But they used multiple effects for doing it. So Joe Barton worked on the Phoenix puppet and the radio-controlled animatronic head that was used for speaking on it and so on. And they did use some CSOs, some green screen or blue screen type effects for, I think, some of the Phoenix flying things, and certainly also for the flying carpet and some of the visuals that they did with that. They did a number of CSO type things in here.
Yes, I know, you know, for the time it looks pretty good, although obviously now it's fairly obvious to our modern eyes, particularly with sharper screens. The color separation overlay, or as you say, chroma key filming. Interesting technique.
Yes, absolutely. Standby that's still being used in lots of things, for sure. The Phoenix and the Carpet was broadcast weekly in 8 parts, beginning on Wednesday, December 29th, 1976.
So it comes in that post-Christmas period, but it doesn't go out on a Sunday tea time, which is where I would have thought it would have been its best fit, just because I've got a memory of all these shows being at Sunday tea time. And I had a look in the BBC Genome, the Radio Times archive, and found that it was in fact repackaged and rebroadcast nearly 2 years later in 1978. But this time they repackaged them as 4 one-hour episodes instead of the 8 just under 30-minute episodes that we've looked at, Brian.
Yes, I could see that being done with something like this. It would work.
And also, of course, there was the book. And if you search for the Phoenix and the Carpet book covers, you will probably find one of the 1970s versions, which of course has got a tie-in image from the series of the four children on the carpet with the Phoenix. And apparently that reissue became one of the best-selling children's books in the UK for 1977. So, you know, this series was very popular, and the tie-in republication of the novel was also a big success as well.
Fascinating that the TV version meant that this book that was more than 70 years old was suddenly a big seller again.
Yeah, absolutely. And it did work. And as I say, you can Google search those images for the book covers.
How interesting.
So let's talk about the availability and how we've been watching this series. In Region 2, we do have a DVD. There's a little bit of sort of controversy as to whether they thought this series was lost or whether the BBC were holding it back for some reason. But eventually it was announced that, yes, the episodes, all 8 episodes, had survived in the BBC archive, which, as we've spoken about many a time, Brian, is not an automatic thing from this era. And they put it out on a Simply Media DVD in 2019. No extras, so you just get the 8 episodes, £12 or thereabouts at the moment, but readily available. We don't have to worry about this one being deleted anytime soon, it seems. Meanwhile, across the pond, as ever, in Region 1...
In Region 1, there is no release. There are some imports available here and there, so check out your various sources for either an import or ordering directly from UK seller. And it is worth noting that the original novel, and in fact all of these Edith Nesbit novels, are still in print.
And of course they have been repackaged, and I think you can buy a book that contains all 3 in one set.
Yes, I would think that would be available, yeah.
So that'll do us for part 1 of our discussion of The Phoenix and the Carpet. We'll be back next time. We're going to talk a little bit more about the children's adventures. I have to say, we are going to talk about 1 or 2 problematical elements of the original story and this version. So we have a few issues to cover when we come back, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And we will give our own thoughts and recommendations and reviews about this show and the DVD. So until then, you can find all of our episodes at BritishInvaders.com or search for British Invaders on Facebook, and you can find our group there. We always have some good discussion going on.
We do indeed, and you can also find British Invaders as a member of the Voice of Geeks Network, which you will find at vognetwork.com, vognetwork.com for the Voice of Geeks.
Absolutely. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much, and this is Eamon in England also signing off.